to the one, I'd like to thank the Pomeroy committee. Certainly appreciate you in the first talk, all of the bodies at this point. Yeah, I also think, you know, this is my personal interest, I have a lot of, cut a lot of time on that out, and just want to share my injuries, try to find best ways to be safe. So, I think this is a important talk, I think this is my personal bias, but I think that the two scariest devastating injuries we're all gonna learn about now, throughout careers, are gonna be closed head injury, probably cervical spine. I think this is an important topic. I don't have any disclosures or any comments of interest in purpose of this talk. Another answer, we can just like.
Go ahead.
No, it's working. Anyway, the last slide was just people from my lab that helped me do a lot of these studies. This is what I gave you all as a handout. What this is an outline of the National Athletic Trainers Association's new protocol or guidelines for dealing with spinal injuries or emergency situations. I was fortunate enough to be asked to be part of a physician and athletic training team that came up with these guidelines. It will be published, I think, in the next few months. One thing I will do is once it's published, I'll make sure I get the Bob Marley and we can distribute it to you all. Maybe next year if I get asked to come back and talk before we specifically what our recommendations are. But what I'd really like to focus on today is a few of the points here, but specifically what to do with the spinal precautions. And then down here, number five, we're gonna talk about, you know, basically how to safely move a patient. We're gonna talk about log rolling and how I don't think that's the ideal method, if there's alternatives. We'll talk a little bit about collars and rigid mobilization devices, specifically long spine backings. So this was a publication that came out a few years ago, and I'm not sure how familiar all of you are with the current things going on as far as management of trauma patients or, you know, in your case, spine injured athletes or anything. But basically, this paper came out in 1998, so it's kind of old. But for some reason, there's a lot of new proposals being made by the American College of Surgeons and Spinal Emergency Medicine personnel, including the physicians as well as EMS. Based on this study, there's a lot of push to try to get rid of spine boards and even potentially cervical collars. Fortunately, again, I was part of the NATA's protocol team, and we are not getting rid of these things at this point, but I just put this up to make you all aware of potential changes in the future. This is a very weak study. It's basically a comparison of an EMS or a level one trauma center in New Mexico compared to a level one trauma center in Malaysia, of all places. And basically, the reason they chose those two places is one of the authors is in New Mexico. They do exactly what we do here. They put people on long spine backboards, collars on, use spinal precautions. Whereas in Malaysia, they don't do any of that. They basically just grab you, throw you on the stretcher, and take you to the hospital. So they only had like 300 patients in the Malaysia group and 120 in the Mexico group. Basically, what they showed was there was no difference in neurological deterioration. So that's the goal here. That's what we're all talking about. So if somebody has a spine injury, we're trying to prevent them from getting worse, right? We're trying to protect the spinal cord and neural components and prevent further deterioration. The problem with that is, so they've got, you know, around 450 patients in total. Only one out of 1,000 spinal injuries are unstable. Those are the ones that we're really worried about. Those are the ones where things can move, bone fragments, herniated disc, whatever causes neurologic damage. So this study is so underpowered, it's unbelievable. And yet, this is what's driving all those potential changes. And I just put this up to kind of make you aware. And you know, this is a personal story of mine. This was my sort of senior mentor at residency at the University of Iowa. He's Garrett Couples, great guy. He was sort of all-American, you know, hero guy. He was a lifeguard. When he was in med school in Philadelphia, he actually jumped into a frozen water to save somebody's life from falling in. He was on the Oprah Winfrey show as a result. Great guy. You can see him when he was young here. And basically, he had an accident or a fall off the balcony. He was neurologically intact, was able to walk after the accident. I think, you know, I don't know if he hit his head or what the deal was. He was a sports trained orthopedic surgeon. And basically, you know, parents were there, didn't ask for them to call EMS or whatnot. Walked up to his apartment, got in bed, got up out of bed, dislocated T11, T12. He's a permanent paraplegic now at this point. Sad thing was, he had a disability, hasn't been able to really brilliant engineering students from the University of Wisconsin built him this chair, which basically allows him to get upright and he can operate again. So it's kind of found new life recently. It's a really sad story, you know, personal to me. It shows that his spinal precautions are important, right? So I think if EMS had been called for him, he'd been placed on board and brought to an adequate trauma center treated by a spine surgeon, he probably would be walking today. So I think, you know, those recommendations of getting rid of spine board and spinal precautions are crazy. And, you know, one thing that's been shown is that prior to having spinal precautions, you know, initiated, basically all patients with spinal cord injury showed up complete, meaning they had no function, they never recovered, nothing. And then thereafter, that ratio complete to incomplete started to favor incomplete patients because I think we were protecting the neural elements to do a good job. So just wanted to touch a little bit about that, and then we're going to move on a little bit to talk about some of the research I've done and my recommendations to you all. But, you know, basically 2% of trauma patients have a cervical spine injury. And we'll talk a little bit about airway management, and it's 10% of these patients will require some type of advanced airway management. You all could potentially be involved with that along with EMS. As far as catastrophic spinal cord injuries, they are rare, but, you know, my point is, just like my friend, you know, you don't want to miss one, but you want to protect neural elements, you want this guy to be walking and not end up with. As far as sports injuries, it's the number 4 cause of spinal cord injury in the U.S. today. Approximately 8% of spinal cord injuries from 2005 to 2010 were caused by sports. Football is the number 1, followed by wrestling. Looking specifically at the NFL, the study was published. So there are a significant number of spinal injuries. 12% of these were non-spinal pelvic fractures. They basically just looked at the whole axial skeleton together. You know, the fortunate thing is that very few were catastrophic spinal cord injuries. But, you know, the point is you don't want to mismanage a single one of these in every step of the management. Should you all be concerned? You know, I kind of already prefaced that. I think that this and closed head injury are really what we really need to manage appropriately, in addition to all sports injuries. But these are the ones where the consequences are really dire, and you know, this can result in catastrophic disability, a severely high cost to society and to the patient and family. It's been estimated to be about $14.5 billion for spinal cord injury in the U.S. annually. Again, we talked about football and wrestling are the number 1, number 2 causes, but there are other sports that certainly have their fair shares of significant spinal cord injuries. You know, and then one critical point here is that, you know, and I've seen this, and we'll talk about a case next, it really does change, you know, what you do as far as the patient goes. So it's been shown that almost up to 30% of spinal cord injury patients can get worse under the care of medical personnel. So, you know, maybe we're not doing things well, and maybe it's time for change, and that's why we propose. But in addition, this just shows that it's really important. This is just a case that, like, I'd like to demonstrate that bad things do happen when doctors, other medical care, and athletic trainers, and everybody else gets involved. And no matter how seasoned or veteran you are, bad things can happen. This is a young patient that I was consulted on as his second opinion after he had been injured. Initially taken him out to another hospital, brought to the medical center. Another spine surgeon had seen the patient and decided to put the patient in a halo. They were neurologically intact when they first came in the hospital. And then post-halo placement with several adjustment x-rays, the patient became a complete quadriplegic, had to be intubated emergently, underwent surgical stabilization, which I would argue would have been necessary for this to begin with, and then the patient died a month later. So this is a terrible story. You know, these are the things we're really trying to avoid. This study actually prompted me to publish a study looking at better ways to put halos on. But, you know what, success stories happen. This is a 50-year-old that was in the tackling drill in practice, and spear tackled one of his teammates. He's got a jump to the center dislocation here at C3, C4. We've got him reduced quickly, which I think is critical when he completes spinal cord injuries. Basically, he couldn't do his right side, he's having the jigger head around the heart syndrome. This is his postoperative MRI. You can see the damage to the board. Here is over at tier rehab, and he's actually made a full recovery. He has a little bit of, you know, tingling numbness. You can think about his hands still, but he's got normal hands and right normally. He plays school, playing soccer now. He's done well. Success stories happen. A little bit about Kevin Everett. He got hurt when I was actually in upstate New York practicing, and obviously he's a big success story. But, you know, things like this, you know, being patients being brought down in their ICU bed, the stretchers and things, prompted me to kind of think about what's going on. And are there better ways to boost spine injury patients? So this is sort of the current paradigm, is that, you know, ATLS protocol says we should log all patients. I'm going to show you that there's better ways. But, you know, again, so my personal bias is that log rolling is suboptimal. This is contrary to traditional teaching, contrary to currently taught ATLS protocols. And I would say that it's not necessary in blunt trauma patients, because you know, the argument by the general surgeons is that if it's a penetrating trauma, you have to inspect their back, make sure there's no, you know, bullet holes or entrance wounds, whatnot. But, you know, I think in a blunt trauma patient, it's applicable, and I don't think you need the log roll patients. It's been shown not by just my lab group, but other authors as well, that it can be harmful. The one caveat I would say, especially in this arena, is that a lot of times we found, or most often it seems, if somebody's badly injured in an athletic arena, that they're found face down. And I would say in that situation, you have no choice, right? You've got to get the face up. One thing I would say, and we look at the lab, probably the safest way to do so is just log roll right onto a board. So if somebody's down and they're not moving, you could have a significant injury, I would just place a board next to them and log roll them up supine. And I don't think that's the best way to do. There were a lot of options. I had a good video of this, but we don't have video today, but not a big deal. But this is my mentor, Glenn Rectine, and he's got one of the cadavers in our lab. What we do is we make unstable spine injuries, we measure the motion between the femoral segments where the injury is. But basically, he's picking that hernia 6 inches and just dropping it onto a hard floor. It's pretty dramatic in the video. You can see the paper recoil off the ground. And what the point here is that that produces less motion to that unstable spine than log rolling a patient under a controlled situation to train it. And we have, this is the data to show it. This is sort of one plane of motion of the neck during this type of movement. And so here you can see, this is the log roll. You can see how much motion there is. This is actually that dropping the gurney 6 inches on the ground. And it does have a pretty significant spike here. It's a heck of a lot of motion that happens when you log roll somebody. Here it is in rotation plane, and here it is in lateral bending. So, you know, again, so I don't know about you, but if I had an unstable spine, I really don't want to be dropped to the ground on the gurney, and I think I'd be pretty unhappy if that happened. But actually being log rolled is what most of the time we do is actually use. What we propose as an alternative used to be called the 6+ person lift. In a recent publication coming out in the NATA guidelines, and we're going to call it the 8 person lift now. I think it makes a lot more sense. I don't know where it came up with 6+ to begin with, because it takes 8 individuals. You can see it being depicted here. So there's 3 individuals on each side with their hands together, just basically, and then the most important person at the head doing manual line stabilization. You basically just levitate the patient off the ground 68 inches, and then the 8th person slides the board under. And basically, we showed that in a bunch of studies to show, you know, during application and then during board removal, that there's less motion and it's better than a log roll. And I would suggest, you know, that you all get together with your teams and learn how to do this. And I think, you know, it's the safest way to get somebody on the board or off. As far as looking at somebody with football equipment on, that's always a challenge. We went back to the lab and recently just looked at that data. This is accepted to open journal of sports medicine, so it should be published in a few months. But basically, we just added up a cadaver and did the same study over again. And there was less motion in all planes, and it actually was really significant for lateral bending, medial lateral translation. So it's a better maneuver than log rolling, you know, if you have football pads at least. We've done a bunch of other studies, published a bunch of other things, looking at moving patients in the hospital and whatnot. This is the most recent study that I published looking at this. Basically, it's looking at a trauma patient or a sports injured athlete with a stable cervical injury. And so we wanted to look at from the time of injury, the medical personnel take care of the patient, the time of surgery, are there better ways of moving the patient rather than using traditional log roll maneuvers? And you know, again, sort of the same background data of why we decided to do this. And we felt there were a lot better potential alternatives to log rolling, and that's what we used. So control group was log rolling, and then alternative group was what we thought was going to be the best case scenario. And again, you know, we made the same unstable cervical injury and went through the different motions. We had 5 cadavers, injury level C5, C6, that's the most common level to be injured in a blunt trauma victim. Probably a little higher for most football players if you're on C3, C4. But similar, subaxial cervical spine. We used 3D electromagnetic motion analysis to look at the movement between the two vertebra during the maneuvers. We did put a collar on the patient. Went through from the time of injury to the time of surgery. So we used, you know, spine boarding, moving the patient from bed to bed, and do something called an air pal mattress, which basically said kind of this light air inflated device, which is really smooth. As far as turning the patient, you can't keep somebody flat all the time, I'm going to do a self-serve. So in the ICUs now, we have a special bed that will tilt the patient versus what was traditionally done, is just lock the leg up. And then this is a special table I have in my operating room. A lot of surgeries go going back in the neck and the back of the spine, so you can get them face down. Just flopping them over face down is bad. I think that this is a much better alternative with obesity. My OR staff calls it the rotisserie maneuver, so basically that's been the patient on the table.
Yeah, and this is a recording of the motion.
Dark blue is the best case scenario, what we thought was the best, and the thick is long going, and you can see a flexion extension that looks better. Same with axial rotation, much bigger spice and movement to the long wing. And then same thing with lateral bending. Those are the three planes of the angular motion. And this is the data I analyzed, and you can see that the log rolling had more motion in every plane, was statistically significant for a couple of the maneuvers, where bend transfer, turning, turn prone, and approach significance for spine cord removal. And axial rotation, we see similar results, but statistical significance for almost all planes except for almost all movements except for the bend transfer. And then as far as lateral bending, same thing. When you add up all those movements, looking at just the means and the average displacements, for all three planes of motion, it's statistically less for using all the better techniques versus log rolling. And then if you look at the maximal displacement, same thing, over 2 to 3 times more displacement than log rolling. So we basically just proved again that log rolling is not the ideal of alternatives, and that's how the injured if you get under my care, and this is how we perform. Limitations of the study, obviously the cadavers aren't ideal, but there's no way of doing this in live studies. You never get iron use in something like this for live. We did only do a single injury pattern in the study, but we actually went back and repeated the study and published that in Journal of Neurosurgery Spine with a thoracic lumbar injury. It was done 2 common injury levels for one common patient, mid cervical and thoracic lumbar, and basically both showed the same results. One sort of caveat to this is like we don't know exactly how much motion is detrimental to the cervical nerve or to the spine. But you know, the goal, and I think we all agree, is to minimize motion as little as possible, and that's what we need to do, and that's what we're trying to show. Obviously, clinical studies would be better, maybe in an animal model, that's something we'll talk about in a little bit too. So, in conclusion, average displacements were significant, almost 2 times with the log roll maneuver. The greatest displacements were even 2 to 3 times with the log rolling versus the better technique. I would argue that log rolling was not the most protective method, contrary to traditional teaching. And again, I think this is a really important topic given the morbidity of having a cervical injury or becoming very significant to both the patient as well as family and society. I mentioned we'll talk a little bit about airway management. Prompted us to look at this study. So the way to get some non-cautious patients' airway open, there's 2 proposed methods. One is a head tilt chin lift, the other is a jaw thrust maneuver. Jaw thrust was proposed less motion in the cervical spine. Recent guidelines have said that we should not use the jaw thrust, but it doesn't matter, and that's based on pretty old studies. So we went in the lab and we did a lumbar cervical injury and looked at this, and jaw thrust way less motion than head tilt chin lift. So our argument is that we still should do a jaw thrust, keep somebody's airway open if you have a suspected cervical injury. We looked at intubation devices. This is maybe a little bit more perfect for EMS, but you all would be hoping your EMS guys, if it's not be necessary in the patient you're taking care of. We looked at the different airway devices, 4 different airway devices that are commonly available. An intubating LMA, a glidoscope, which is basically a video laryngoscope, slip device. The NFL now, as well as a traditional Macintosh blade, and then something called a light wand. Basically, we shut the light wand and the glidoscope, the best device, just release the amount of motion that you have to basically get advanced airway or innovate injured athlete. Problem with the light wand is if you see through the skin, so you're keeping darker complexions, it's difficult. On the other problem is daytime game, or even at night with bright lights, it's pretty impossible. So we've advocated using a glidoscope, and again, that's what I've done. As far as football pad removal goes, this is a very controversial topic, removing the helmet or the football pads. The current recommendations that are going to come out by NATA are actually going to be, again, I think this is a whole different topic of discussion, are going to be that you all remove the pads and the helmet prior to coming to the hospital. I think it's a debatable point. I don't think, for professional sports, we're going to do that. We also have the luxury of, having a stadium you can go into, and x-rays, and do things like that. It's not available to you all. We did look at this in the lab, and there are better techniques for removing pads. This is what we call the torso elevation technique. And again, we can discuss that at another time. The other thing is like ripcord pads and some new devices out there, which we're currently looking at in the lab. I think the whole pad helmet removal thing is another topic to discuss, sort of a debatable topic, so maybe a gray area. So in conclusion, you know, we talked about somebody getting worse neurologically after their initial injury, secondary neurologic injury, is what you were really all talking about preventing here, and it's really critical in taking care of these patients. As you know, all must be treated as though they have an unstable spine injury if you suspect they have any spine injury at all until proven otherwise. Again, sort of my research is very contrary to what everybody else in the country thinks and what's traditionally taught. And I would just encourage you all, we've proven that it's better than log rolling, and log rolling is probably not the best maneuver. But I would encourage you all to question what you know, or question what your goal, what you read, and you know, think if you think something's better, you know, maybe you get it, we'll do some research in the lab and try to test it what you're thinking. You know, we've even gotten, this was an invited article by Surgical Neurology International, which I was one of the authors on, and basically, look at the title, it's pretty dramatic. We've even gone as far as the publishing paper was quite, that we should eliminate and model the spine problem. And again, I just want to remind you all, these are two pretty devastating upper cervical injuries. I think these are both motor vehicle collisions, but you can see complete dissociation of spine levels. But you know what, if you haven't typically injured in football and other athletics, in the upper cervical, so these levels, this is 2-3, 3-4, this is the most common level in sports. The thing about these injuries are, is a little bit of movement here. I mean, these are grossly unstable injuries, so you may have to deal with one of these at some point in your career. The other thing that's critical here is not only are they potentially going to become quadriplegic, but the respiratory muscles, the diaphragm specifically, were innervated by C3, C4, C5. So if you damage the cord in the upper cervical area like this, the patient could stop breathing and die. We're not only just talking about devastating neurologic injury, we're also talking about death. So I would argue that there's a lot at stake with these injuries, close attention, and I think back to this slide, it's basically sort of a recommendation outline of what you all should do as far as your schools and the athletics you take care of. And I would say, I can get you the guidelines and the protocol. It'd be important to go through those things, make sure you have a plan, make sure you practice it with the individuals that can be there. You want to be smooth if you have to take care of these patients. And, one other thing I would recommend to you all is, a lot of times these patients initially get taken to another hospital, another facility, they can't care for these patients. I think that's an important point here. The last point is make sure you take the hospital to provide immediate definitive, I think the key word there is definitive care for these patients. I get a lot of patients with complete spinal cord injuries that initially go to a smaller hospital than a medical center. If you think somebody has an unstable cervical or any spinal injury at all, please just break them down to us because they're going to end up with you anyway. It just delays their care going to an outside hospital and then somebody getting a scan in there and ER could not call the spine surgeon because they're not going to take care of it. They're going to send it to the med center. And, time is critical with these patients and they could get worse. So I would encourage you all to not try to our bargain for business here, but that's what happens in our city of Houston here. So, it's fine if the outside hospitals, come to you and say we want to take your spinal injuries. The current system is that they all end up in med center, so it's better just to come straight to us. And I'd like to thank you all for inviting me to talk today.